Professor Glazer's First Amendment class, November 26, 2008, and 205.
I heard this was coming. It's on?
Yes.
I apologize for it taking so long also, but it's been an undertaking.
Yeah, I'm sure. I found this interesting hearing myself speak on a podcast. It's funny how you don't sound the same.
I never like to listen to myself talk. No. And I'm sure that now that I have a cold, it'll be even more embarrassing. I think I never feel right with the clock here, but okay. So this is the last day of new stuff, which means that as I told you, the much awaited podcast will be up over the Thanksgiving break. I'll let you know. I'll send you an email via Twen just so that you're not, left wondering where it is and all of that. And I'll also send you, probably in pieces, those of you who've had me before, are familiar with when it comes close to final, the idea that I send outlines and pieces before the test. So I'll be doing that over the break. I imagine that you all will be having a similar Thanksgiving break, and that's fine. I always liked the Thanksgiving break for paper writing and outlining and that sort of thing. So I don't know if you share my fondness for it, but you certainly, I imagine, understand that happens. So that's on the more administrative side of things. But I also want to tell you this now to alert you to the fact that I'm taking questions. So far, I haven't gotten questions from you for the purpose of my answering them over the review sessions. The review session will be on Tuesday, which is our last class. We don't have class on Monday because it's a legislative Thursday. But our class on Tuesday will be 2 hours of review session. I imagine that some of that review session time will be spent, talking about outline, reciting some of the outline of the course or whatever, probably because that's the way that some of your questions will be best answered. but I would like to have the class on Tuesday dedicated to your agenda. So please email me questions that, I hope you don't mind if I don't respond substantively to, but for the purpose of my responding to them in class. I won't mention your name when responding to them or anything like that. So just send me questions. That's what I need. Okay. My voice is getting better, but it sounds to me like even weirder. Okay. So today, our last bit of new material is about the free exercise clause, which we've talked about in the sense that we have said what it is. It's one of the religion clauses. The general approaches that we talked about when we went over, I guess now it's two classes ago, the eight approaches to the religion clauses also hold true for this religion clause, right? Because those are general approaches to the religion clauses collectively. So the eight, things that I put on the board that appear in the notes from the first reading on the religion clauses also pertain to this clause. And as opposed to the Establishment Clause, which tells us that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, the Free Exercise Clause tells us that Congress shall make no law prohibiting the free exercise of religion, which essentially means what it sounds like it means, right? We've talked about, Reva and I have had a conversation that I've referenced before about the fact that the Free Exercise Clause has the most analog to the speech clause, right? The reason for that is essentially that, you know, the free exercise clause basically says that people can think or believe anything that they want to think or believe in, right? Which is similar to the way that the speech clause works, right? So, for example, you know, the state can't make a law that is viewpoint discriminatory, so that essentially means that, you know, if you have a particular viewpoint, then a state statute, an ordinance, a rule, a policy in school, whatever it is, that infringes on your ability to have that belief, even if it's not religious, that's going to violate the speech clause of the First Amendment. So, too, that type of law, right, or that rule or policy or ordinance or school policy that infringes on your right pursuant to the free exercise clause to think or believe whatever you want to, that is going to run afoul of the First Amendment, but the free exercise clause of the First Amendment. So for that reason, there's an analog between between the speech clause and the free exercise clause in a way that there's not as much of one in the context of the Establishment Clause. We said last time, so a bit of review, that the Establishment Clause is different from the speech clause in the sense that it's a top-down approach versus a bottom-up approach. Do you remember this conversation? So essentially, in the context of the speech clause, the purpose of the speech clause is to allow the populace to convince the government to do something other than what it's doing, right? So sure, we talk about lots of things, right? Obscenity, we talk about, you know, lots of different topics, but the highest of high-value speech, which is always sort of the ideal speech that we could possibly engage in, right? Even if a particular case talks about something that doesn't quite meet that ideal, right? Always in the back of the court's mind and in the back of our minds as we're going through the speech clause jurisprudence is this idea that the most holy, right, speech that you can engage in is about politics. And specifically about, you know, dissenting against whatever the majority practice is and whatever the government's policy currently is, right, the status quo. That's the purpose of the speech clause, is to allow people to voice their opinions against the government. It's a check on democracy. That's the, you know, prototypical marketplace of ideas type of speech. Okay? That means, right, that the highest of high-value speech is intended to cause the government to do something different from what it's doing. Okay? So that's not always going to happen, but in the ideal case, the highest of high-value speech is going to be that. That's not the sort of thing that we're concerned with when we talk about either of the religion clauses. When we're talking about either of the religion clauses, the idea is not that through your either free exercise, you know, believing in whatever you think is right, thinking whatever you think is right religiously, the idea is not that those members of the populace who have a particular religious belief are going to, through their religious belief, convince the government to also hold that religious belief. That's not the point, right? The point is, you know, either to, whether you take a freedom of religion or a freedom from religion stance to the religion clauses collectively, neither of those interpretations of the religion clauses gets you to this understanding of the religion clauses that's similar to the speech clause in the sense that the populace is going to convince the government to do something different. Right? That's not what we're talking about in the context of religion. So either we're talking about, you know, protecting the populace from the government's influence as to whatever religion that populace is going to adopt, or we're going to cause a further separation, you know, an absolute barrier between the government and the populace, or both, some hybrid of the two. Whatever your approach is, there's never this bottom-up, right, the populace convincing the government to adopt a particular religious belief aspect of the religion clauses, which is a difference, a fundamental difference between the speech clause and the religion clauses collectively. Okay, but there is, as we've said, an analog between the way that the free exercise clause works, right, what the Free Exercise Clause is designed to protect, namely an individual citizen's right to think or believe whatever she wants to, and the Speech Clause. Okay, so there is an analog, but there's also a dissimilarity. Now, the jurisprudence of the Free Exercise Clause has changed drastically from a case from the let's see, the year on Reynolds, from 1961, is it? No, from 1878. So from 1878, we've got Reynolds, which is quite different from Employment Division against Smith. So Employment Division against Smith was a relatively recent case, 1990. And through that history, we've got a drastic difference between, you know, the holdings of the various cases. And there are a few of them that the book touches upon. They're relatively famous. Some of them are very, very famous. And they're really interesting facts. But what's the main difference between the holding in Reynolds and the holding in Smith? Why don't we just say, first of all, before saying the differences, what the holding in Reynolds is and what the holding in Smith is. So, let's see, 1126. So, Hillary, you want to help us out with that? Oh, Hillary's not here. Mike? Murphy?
Yes.
Hey.
Well, in Reynolds, the Supreme Court upheld a conviction of a Mormon for bigamy, saying that the Free Exercise Clause does not require Congress was deprived of all legislative power over mere opinions, but was left free to reach actions which were in violation of social duties or subversive of good order.
Okay. So what does that mean?
That means that the Free Exercise Clause prevents Congress from saying that people have to, that the clauses prevent Congress from saying people have to be a certain religion or can't be this religion.
Right. Well, why would...
They can legislate against other... They can legislate against actions that might incidentally be part of a certain religion's...
Mm-hmm. Okay. So why would the Mormon at issue think that it was his right to engage in bigamy pursuant to the Free Exercise Clause? I mean, it's not there, but, you know, just, yeah.
Just from the plain language of the clause.
Yeah, so this is something that is, you know, part of this person's religious belief, right? So you know, not until, I think it was 1891, I could be a little off on that date, 1890 or 1891, was when the Mormon Church, you know, dissociated itself from the practice of bigamy officially. And this was certainly in light of the Reynolds decision, but this came before, right? So this decision was when the Mormon Church and bigamy, you know, I don't know that much about Mormon history, so I imagine that preceding the 1890 or 1891 decision of the Mormon Church to dissociate itself from bigamy, there was probably, you know, some division within those practicing Mormons between those who said, you know, we're into bigamy and those who said we're not, right? But clearly whoever was you know, the plaintiff in this case associated with bigamy, and it was not something that the Mormon Church dissociated itself from officially at this point. So, you know, much like we can imagine religious beliefs conflicting with the law, right? This was one of those cases, right, where we have, you know, a law against bigamy, which infringed on a core tenet of the Mormon religion, but because the First Amendment says that Congress can't make a law that infringes on your free exercise of religion, you know, somebody who believes in this core tenet of this religion would think that it's his right, pursuant to the Free Exercise Clause, to engage in bigamy, But no, right? But the conviction that this guy incurred for bigamy was upheld. And you're absolutely right. So Congress says, you know, so rather the court said that Congress was deprived of all legislative power over mere opinion. Okay, so it's true, according to the court in Reynolds, right, that the free exercise clause means that Congress can't enact a law that says you, a Mormon or whoever, you know, religious person, can't believe in something, right? That would run afoul, that would violate the First Amendment pursuant to the Free Exercise Clause. But the court goes on to say that Congress, pursuant to the Free Exercise Clause, or in spite of the Free Exercise Clause, was left free to reach actions which were in violation of social duties or subversive of good order. Laws are made for the government of actions, and while they can't interfere with mere religious belief and actions, they may with practices. So the Reynolds Court provides to us, as you said quite correctly, Mike, this division between beliefs and actions. Okay? So that's worthy of throwing up on the board if I have a marker, which it does not look like I do. So if I had a marker, I would probably put up on the board beliefs versus actions as a dichotomy that derives from the Reynolds decision. Okay, so that dichotomy cashes out to mean that Congress, that the court's interpretation of the Free Exercise Clause means that Congress can't enact a law that reaches beliefs, but it can enact a law that reaches pure actions, practices. Okay, and bigamy, of course, in this case, was counted as an action, so therefore Reynolds' conviction under this anti-bigamy law was fine. Right? It was upheld. Okay. Now, what is the holding in Smith, Mike?
In Smith, the court upheld an Oregon anti-drug statute that prohibited the use of peyote.
Mm-hmm.
This was challenged from a Native American whose religious beliefs required the use of the sacramental use of peyote.
Okay, right. So in the Smith case, so much later, 1990, the court basically radically changes its free exercise jurisprudence. How is that true? Well, in Smith, we've got a challenge by Native Americans, or American Indians, however you think it's appropriate to refer to that population, to an Oregon law that prohibited the use of peyote, which is a hallucinogenic type of drug, obviously illegal. And there, the challenge was to the state's determination, specifically that religious use of peyote, which resulted in these plaintiffs' dismissal from their employment, constituted misconduct that disqualified them from the receipt of their unemployment compensation benefits. Okay, so they did drugs, and that was the reason they were fired, and they couldn't, as a result, collect their unemployment compensation, which was the state action, right? But the court says that is fine. Okay? So Justice Scalia, in the Smith case, writes for the majority, rejects the claim that free exercise of religion requires an exemption from what is otherwise valid law. So he says, we have never held that an individual's religious beliefs excuse him from compliance with an otherwise valid law that prohibits conduct that the state is free to regulate. On the contrary, he says, the record of more than a century of our free exercise jurisprudence contradicts that proposition. So in so holding, Justice Scalia declared that the right of free exercise does not relieve an individual of the obligation to comply with a valid and neutral law of general applicability on the ground that the law proscribes or prescribes conduct that his religion prescribes or proscribes. Okay. So there is a shift in the level of scrutiny, that the court engages in, that the court uses to assess rules that are of general applicability, that affect disproportionately, you know, members of a particular religion. So Justice Scalia says that because we are a cosmopolitan nation made up of people of almost every conceivable religious preference, and precisely because we value and protect that religious divergence, we can't afford the luxury of deeming presumptively invalid, as applied to the religious objector, every regulation of conduct that does not protect an interest of the highest order. So essentially, the court says that those seeking religious exemptions from laws should look to the democratic process for protection and not to the courts. So there is, because of the level of scrutiny over time, right, that the court employs when reviewing laws that pertain to, you know, religious people in a particular way, right, that goes from a strict scrutiny review to something less than strict scrutiny, that is a huge huge departure in the jurisprudence. Now, we haven't focused so much on, you know, the type of review, right? That wasn't, you know, a focus of our discussions in prior cases, but what we have said a few times is that, you know, it's going to be more likely, assuming that a court is reviewing with strict scrutiny a particular law, right, that law is going to be struck down, right? Okay. So Mike, what do you think of these decisions? What do you think of the Reynolds decision and or the Smith decision?
I think in Smith, Scalia took the idea of law, you know, what laws should and shouldn't be have religious exemptions a little too far. Because I think as a general proposition that the laws that should be upheld against free exercise claims should be like criminal laws that are considered malum in se.
Okay. So this is
or rape, as opposed to things like
drug
use.
Right. So if we're talking, you know, bigamy, possibly, right? Or we're talking about, you know, genital mutilation or something that might be a part of a particular religion's core practices, then that should kind of be segregated for the court's reasoning, at least, from laws that don't really implicate those sorts of things. So your division between malum in se and malum prohibitum is a useful one. Because, of course, there is a difference between, you know, laws that would kind of cause us to think that you know, this is really kind of an immoral practice. There's a harm that is incurred by a particular person or persons as a result of this law, as opposed to a law saying, yeah, or a practice, rather, that's a core religious belief. Or that emanates from a core religious belief that says, you know, we use these drugs at this time. Okay. But isn't it possible that in, you know, I imagine that some of you are at least somewhat familiar with the counterarguments that religious groups have put forward about, you know, their particular practices, like bigamy or like even genital mutilation or, you know, causing women and not men to wear a particular garb that might be seen to the kind of outside world as sexist or something like this, where, you know, there's a pretty big defense that is put forward by members of these religions, and often those defenses are put forward by the people who, you know, one might think are being victimized. So, for example, you know, I mean, you're probably all familiar with Big Love, and, you know, obviously that's a TV show, but there are, I think there's an LA Times video. It's like a news story that has a video component as well, that basically has, you know, the story of a polyamorous marriage in a Mormon, you know, setting where the wives are actually the ones who are saying, well, this is great, right? You might think that, you know, bigamy or polygamy might generate abuse and all these other things, and it's really terrible. But assuming that you're not violating any consent laws, assuming that you're not violating any age restrictions or anything like that, which this family wasn't, it was pretty similar to the family in Big Love, which, if those of you who aren't familiar, you know, it does not involve children. Right, does not involve marriage to children. There's a pretty big defense put forward. The same thing with genital mutilation or female genital cutting, whatever you want to call it. There are a lot of people who say really bad things about it, but there are also people who say, well, you know, A, male cutting is just as bad, and there's a pretty big movement against that on the part of, you know, people whose religions have mandated that they have, you know, circumcision, which is pretty acceptable. So that's kind of a counterpoint to those who argue against female genital cutting. And also there are, you know, people who have had female genital cutting that basically say, like, well, this is my religion, this is exactly what I believe in, and I think it's better, and here's why. So what about that? What about the fact that, you know, certain practices that you, according to your analysis, would sever, right? You would say those are the malum in ses. Those are the ones that are really bad, and those are the ones that when the court reviews them should be reviewed differently from the drug laws. What do you say to that, Rosa?
I think that even though, like, maybe a particular person practicing their religious might not seem to have, like, a negative effect on society, mm-hmm. I think if you aggregate the practices, they might have a particular negative effect on society. And I think that's what a lot of people are concerned about.
Well, I wonder, I mean, I think that's a valid point. That, you know, we're trying to make society harmed less, right? And so if we have a practice like bigamy or like female genital cutting or something, you know, like that is pretty mean, right, to a certain class of people, like women, that should influence our decision. And just because we have a testimonial from one particular woman who was not only not bothered but by this practice but actually thought it was great, that, you know, might kind of provide one testimonial, but really we're going for kind of aggregate effects. But I wonder, even though that's a valid point, I wonder if the free exercise clause, much like the speech clause, is supposed to be about something more fundamental. We're not trying to, you know, assess the effects in kind of, you know, simplistic, utilitarian ways, but instead, this is about, you know, this is a core tenet of a religion, and that's exactly what's supposed to be protected by the free exercise clause. I see a lot of hands. Brooke?
Yes, I think it's important, it's the last statement in the majority opinion when they say that the Democratic Party is not a system that is challenging the law into itself, so there's a bigger purpose for these laws. And if, you know, I don't remember if this case or another case,
mm-hmm.
where they say that if your religion says that supporting a government is sinful, so you think you don't have to pay taxes, you know, if every exception to the rule had to be made, you wouldn't have rules.
Okay. Yeah, and that's totally valid, right? That, you know, clearly there is a slippery slope that we see in action as we read through these cases, right? Because essentially, what is a religion? That's something that we talked about right at the very beginning you know, that defining what religion is, particularly when you have, you know, interpretations of the religion clauses like number 6, the equal liberty interpretation, which says there's nothing special about religion, religion and speech are the same, then that leads us to ask, well, what's a religion? So what I mean by asking that question is, couldn't we right now form a religion that, you know, our core tenets would be that we don't want to pay taxes, we don't want to do lots of things that the law would say that we have to do.
Well, I would make the analogy that those are some like world value speech, where there may be a speech component to them, but we don't recognize, like, general manipulation of that using it. Okay, you know, it may be speech or expressive speech or maybe a core tenet of religion, but there's something about it that's so valuable to society that we're not going to do.
That's very good.
It's interesting that there is a unemployment case. Leads us to ignore the unemployment and really go right back to Reynolds and sort of say, hey, it's a freedom of acting, and we allow to limit acting as illegal.
Yep.
We can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of just like bypasses what's in front of them. They just
What do you mean that what's bypassed?
Well, because it's a they're suing on the unemployment rights, not on whether or not the law to make peyote illegal should be overturned, right?
But I mean, there's a trigger effect there, right? They were fired as a result of the drug use, and because that was the reason that they were fired, they weren't allowed to collect their compensation. So if they were fired for something else, then their treatment would have been different.
Right.
So there was a difference because of the religious practice.
But there could be an argument to say that, well, because this is an unemployment issue, it should be treated like the Amish woman,
the Yoder.
The Yoder case, and that because the unemployment itself, even though it was an illegal act, was a religious trigger, it should be okay, instead of invalidating the law itself.
I guess so. I mean, you know, it's certainly a valid point, but I wonder if essentializing the cases to mean, you know, that if there's kind of a one-step removal from the religion versus not, that that's going to make a case turn a particular way if that doesn't provide fodder for loopholes, right? So then you can imagine that if that was the reason that cases would come out differently, meaning if the law directly versus one step removed, like in the Smith case, affected one's religious beliefs, then that's going to make a case come out differently, then I wonder whether there would be kind of creative lawmaking that would be invited by the court, because then, you know, so long as you're one step removed, you're fine. You understand what I'm saying? So I don't know. I think it's an interesting point, but I don't know if that is going to solve anything, just because then legislators are smart and they would be able to make kind of two-step laws that would fall under this new exception to the religion clause.
I totally agree with and recognize the problem that Brooke pointed out in terms of what they say to Smith, that like once you start, you know, highly protecting religion, like everything can be folded under religion.
Right.
At the same time, it says free exercise, not free thinking about religion. And I have a little bit of a problem with how limited the court is in protecting people's right to exercise their religion. Like I said, they draw this big distinction between thinking about your religion and believing in it and what you actually do. But what the words of the Constitution say is, no, it doesn't say we protect your right of free thought.
Right. I'd even take it more one step further, which is to say, how would a law ever constitutionally, even absent the religion clauses, be able to be constitutional if it actually claims to inhibit the way you thought,
right?
So even if we're not talking about religion, any sort of exercise is always going to be what we're talking about. So even if we go back to, you know, our discussion in the speech context of symbolic conduct, right, remember when we talked about that, we said, well, there's not really any difference between, you know, hardcore speech or speech in the strict sense versus some conduct that is expressive. That distinction is something that, you know, a very elementary understanding of speech would yield, but not one that is at all textured, not one that is, you know, truly in line with what the Constitution has to mean.
So too, in the context of free exercise, of course we're talking about practice, right? We wouldn't be able to touch thinking, even if it weren't religious. Yeah. All right.
Yeah, it's like, where do you, just building on that, it's like, where do you draw the line between beliefs and acts? Like,
right.
You have a law saying going to church on Sunday is illegal.
Mm-hmm.
And act, there's that part of your belief.
Mm-hmm.
It's very,
right, because what are your beliefs if they don't cause you to act in some particular way? And even if, you know, you could draw a distinction between beliefs and acts, how would it be possible for a law to only touch beliefs? Right? Because what would the law look like? You know, it shall be unlawful to think about God in a particular way. How would that be a law? Mark, you had your hand up.
I don't like the fact that they get to choose which acts are mm-hmm. legal, which acts can go against a law and
mm-hmm.
which can't, because taking a sacrament, if you're underage, breaks the law.
Right.
And, you know, American Indians, for the most part, didn't touch alcohol. They didn't know what it was
mm-hmm.
until Europeans came here. So they might just, you know, what we think is a crazy thing for them to do is normal
mm-hmm.
for them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not allowing them to do it.
Right. So essentially, you know, you're advocating for a pluralistic way of kind of dealing with different people's beliefs. And what might seem kind of odd to the rest of us is totally not odd to someone else and vice versa. So I imagine that, you know, by the same token, following your logic, there could be things that we think are completely normal that American Indians would not think are completely normal. Yeah.
Thanks. In response to, you know, how would you think along with it? I mean, you know, all right, well, if you believe in the monotheistic God, so you're fired because we're allowed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, that's just belief. Like, maybe mm-hmm. the Bible once you thought it was pretty good, and so
mm-hmm.
you're in God, but you're not in front. Like, I think a lot of these contexts, we always think of, like, zealots who are all, like, and it might be too harsh a word, but people who are
yeah.
who really subscribe to religious doctrines. Maybe it's just people. It could be. You could
mm-hmm.
imagine that. Anyway, that was just
yep.
like an aside.
Yeah.
I like the equal liberty sort of argument to think about these cases, because I like to try to, like, I don't like to elevate, like, the religion.
Mm-hmm.
I like to think of it just in terms of, you know, you're free to associate and express how you want.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully that'll allow religious things to flourish and all that. But, and I'm not articulating this properly, but I think because of that, I found the dissent compelling.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the type of thing where it's like, you know, this is something that they do and that's their practice. Okay, so why is that wrong? I need a justification. Maybe not necessarily compelling interest, but something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they say, oh, war on drugs. Well, you don't prosecute these people.
Right.
So obviously, it's not really integral to your war on drugs if you're not prosecuting these people and you know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Half the other states say it's okay. What's really the reason?
Mm-hmm.
I need a real reason, not just because I said so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Perhaps you just merely guess, but as I'm reading Scalia's opinion, I just don't see how the jurisprudence has changed this Reynolds.
It's
going straight back to that standard.
Right.
As long as it's for the social good of, you know, humanity that we ban this, we're allowed to do it.
Right. And there's certainly, I mean, you're right to question that. So there's certainly ways of reading Reynolds and Smith as totally consonant with each other. The big difference is the level of scrutiny that the court is going to use when assessing these types of laws, which was abandoned in the Smith case. The strict scrutiny was abandoned in the Smith case that was not abandoned in earlier cases. So that's the big difference. And even though we've not focused our attention on, you know, whether a law gets strict scrutiny or otherwise, but we have said that if a law gets strict scrutiny, then it's going to be most likely to be struck down as opposed to not struck down. So there's basically like a higher respect for a particular law if the court, or any lower court for that matter, is going to assign strict scrutiny to its review. That particular part of the free exercise jurisprudence was abandoned in Smith, which is a big difference between Smith and the earlier cases. So just
because we only have about 10 minutes, I want to quickly go through, you know, the different sets of facts in the middle cases. Not because those are, you know, going to change our discussion, but it just might give us kind of, you know, more facts to work with. So in the Braunfeld case, the court held that the free exercise rights of an Orthodox Jew required by his religious faith to close his business from sundown Friday to sundown Saturday, and by state law to remain closed on Sunday were not violated by the state's action. So the court held basically that this indirect burden on a religious believer of a general law that was enacted to advance the state's goals could not form the basis of a free exercise claim. Okay? So there, just to repeat, you know, the Orthodox Jew says, I have free exercise rights to close my business from sundown on Friday to sundown on Saturday. And the state law says, well, you have to remain closed on Sunday. That free exercise right was not violated by this particular state action to remain closed on Sunday. And this was called an indirect burden. Because the state had, you know, kind of other goals besides kind of making this particular person's business not flourish, that was held to be okay. So that's the Braunfeld case. We've got the Werner case. We've got here, you know, Mrs. Sherbert refuses to work, and we have let me just think. I want to. You can skip that case only because there the discussion about is about accommodations, which is part of what I said we would not focus on. That was part of the, you know, the reading, the last reading that I took out. So I think that will probably confuse our discussion more than it will help our discussion. But the Yoder case is a really famous case. So there we've got, you know, the court holding impermissible this compulsory attendance law in the state of Wisconsin as applied to Amish school children. And there's a, you know, distinction between religious and non-religious beliefs there, which causes the court to find that the Amish are motivated to remove their children from school after the eighth grade for religious reasons, and after noting, you know, the good works and the law-abidingness and insular nature of the Amish, finds that their constitutional rights were violated by this law. So why should the Amish get relief from a perceived burden that the follower of, you know, some other teaching philosophy, the Thoreau teaching philosophy, for example, wouldn't get, right? So here, you know, this is a good case for thinking about, you know, why the First Amendment singles out religion as opposed to, you know, some other belief. So this is, you know, directly related to the discussion we were having a moment ago about, you know, the sixth of the eight possible approaches to the religion clauses, right? Namely, the idea that religion is nothing special, and if you've got a particular belief, whether it's a religious belief or whether it's, you know, just some view that you have, that should be treated equally, right? So here, you know, the Yoder court says that there is a particular distinction that should be made for religious practices or religious beliefs as distinct from non-religious ones, right? Which might suggest that, you know, the other cases could have gone the other way, right? The Peyote case, the Reynolds case. So what about, you know, taking your children out of school is different from engaging in, you know, drug use? Mm-hmm.
Well, the court talks about having fundamental right to control the upbringing of your children, whereas you don't have fundamental right to take peyote.
Okay.
So I think that that's the main difference.
Mm-hmm. And this works quite nicely into your high-value, low-value scheme, which I think is, I want to emphasize, I think that's a very helpful way to think about the free exercise cases, particularly it's a nice contribution to, you know, the literature that suggests that there is an analog between the free exercise clause and the speech clause. So it would make a nice paper, to the extent you're looking for a paper. But there, you know, there is this kind of distinction between, you know, on the one hand, education, and on the other hand, drug use. There is also a distinction between, you know, having a fundamental right, as you say, to control the upbringing of your children versus not having that sort of fundamental right. Now, the tricky thing about, you know, interpreting Yoder as a case that you know, really puts forward this fundamental right to cause, you know, the upbringing of your children to be one way versus another way, is that if you engage with not the religion cases, but the children's rights cases, that's not always going to be true. Right. So despite the fact that in Yoder, you know, the parents have this right, there are other children's rights cases that don't, you know, hold that particular view. And there are, you know, reasons that are beyond the scope of this class that are more for a children's rights class about why that is. But I just want to note that while for now we could say, well, you have this fundamental right to control the upbringing of your children, that's not always going to hold, that's not always going to carry the day in the context of you know, these cases. The Pierce case, which is in your book, is another decision like that. Okay, so with respect to free exercise, right, we've got kind of cases going every which way. The high-value, low-value distinction is a helpful one to kind of explain, you know, why some cases come out one way and some cases come out another way. So, for example, if you're talking about education, if you're talking about, what else? I suppose that's what we've got. But you would, you know, employ, if you're talking about something that's not going to have kind of a deleterious effect on society, or a deleterious effect on, you know, particular people in society or a class of people in society, then that's going to fall into this high value category versus, you know, drug use versus bigamy. That's going to fall into a low value category. Michael.
Isn't that sort of just the type of scrutiny? That sort of meaning when you apply the scrutiny, you ask what the government's interest is.
Sure.
And you have these go different how compelling or how necessary
right.
the interest is.
Yeah, but I mean,
the high-value, low-value thing is built into the scrutiny.
Sure. Well, that's yeah, I think that's right. But I think that, you know, just knowing the scrutiny isn't going to get you all that far, because of course, you know, I mean, sure. Here's why I like that better than the scrutiny, because first of all, even though the particular type of scrutiny was abandoned in Smith, the results in Reynolds and Smith are consonant with each other, so that's one. Secondly, even though stress scrutiny can generate for us a high percentage of cases that are going to be struck down, it doesn't generate for us 100%. So that's why I think the high-low value might be kind of more helpful than just focusing on the scrutiny. But you're right. I mean, that's certainly, you know, built in the same way that it's built into the speech cases, in the same way that, you know, if something is a viewpoint discrimination law that runs afoul of the free speech clause, and that's going to generate a strict scrutiny analysis from the court. So you're certainly right, but I think that there's some other value in thinking about it in terms of high and low value. So that's one way of dividing the cases. Yeah, Jess?
Just a question. If we're dividing certain practices into high value and low value, aren't you basically making a judgment on which religious beliefs matter for society?
Sure.
Isn't that just saying that, okay, the majority is controlling what's acceptable in society?
Yeah, no. I'm not defending, and I don't think that you're defending the practice, right? Yeah.
I'm just saying that I think that we're comfortable with it, and
protected speech aspect, like we're comfortable saying that you can't murder someone for an expressive purpose, so we're comfortable making laws for the good of society in that arena. I think that that's what's going on in the
Yeah, right. I think the point is to be descriptive, not prescriptive about it. So essentially to say, like, here are the cases, we have no way of kind of really saying why they make sense. If the reason, right, if the free exercise clause just says that you can believe in whatever the hell you want to, then why should it matter that part of what you believe in is drug use or part of what you believe in is bigamy versus part of what you believe in is homeschooling, right? If all you're saying is it's the fact that it emanates from a religion that matters, then the cases don't make sense, right? The cases start to make more sense, and that's why I said this is a descriptive tool. If you sort, you know, the beliefs into, or the practices into high and low value practices, you're certainly right that, you know, just because that's the way the cases have come out, that doesn't mean that they're right, right? It just means that they are. That's what I mean by this being descriptive. So that, I think, is a very helpful way to understand, you know, these particular cases. But, of course, it's not a way that is totally defensible. Yeah?
So just to our curiosity, so if the state can look at, like, the religion practices and decide whether it's high value or low value, a bit towards the content of the statute.
Yeah.
But, I mean, wouldn't that make it more doubtful that the statute is, like, really neutral in its purpose? It's, like, they're just trying to, like, regulate, like, social order versus, like, they might have some sort of discrimination against that particular religion.
I mean, it's certainly possible, but I don't know, you know, I don't know that it makes it any more likely. I don't think that distinction really goes to the statute so much as it goes to the contents of the religion, right? So, again, you know, it's not to say that this is a defensible practice. It's just to say that this seems to be one way of explaining what's going on in the cases. Yeah?
Being an atheist or an agnostic, that's affected by the religion of others.
Mm-hmm.
So why isn't Thoreau's philosophy or the Greek cynics or why are they just thrown to the side?
Yeah. No, I mean, and that goes to the heart of, you know, trying to define what religion is. Again, you know, there's not a terribly good answer to the question. The question is better than the answer, which is, you're right, right? Like, I'm not saying that the equal liberty stance is the wrong one. It just doesn't seem to be one that courts always employ.
Mm-hmm. I don't know why I said that, regardless of how I actually think about it, but I just keep seeing, like, going back to Reynolds, it's about, you know, how the society, not so much high value or low value, but what's the effect of the society on a whole for prohibiting this action. And I look at, like, the Goldman v. Weinberger, which, again, is military, so it's more restrictive.
Yeah.
But there, even though, you know, Akiva is not very obstructive.
Right.
They take it to the extent and go, hey, but if you had dreadlocks, if you had, that would be much more. And so they're looking at, instead of, I think, high value, low value, they're looking at the effect of society. If it had been a Rastafarian who said, hey, we don't want our children going to school, they get, you know, bad buzz, I think that wouldn't have been upheld by the court.
Right, right. Which is a nice response to Mark, and Mark would still say, well, I think that's wrong, but you and I would say, well, yeah, we might think that's wrong too, but that seems to be the way that things go. The last word, so high and low value, I think, is a helpful distinction. The other distinction, of course, is this distinction between pure belief and action and belief as a hybrid, right? So that, you know, kind of breaks down that distinction between just believing in something versus believing in something and having that belief translate into an action of one sort or another, is definitely what the court seems to think is, you know, the dichotomy, right? That, you know, if the law only infringes on thinking, then that's not okay. It's going to be struck down. If the law only infringes on acting, then that's totally fine. Right, and if the law infringes on a hybrid of belief and action, then that's going to be the gray area of the religion clauses. But, you know, in any particular, just like speech, right, anything you do that's religious can be framed as though it's belief, can be framed as though it's action. action can be framed as though it's some hybrid of belief and action. So, for example, you know, in the Yoder case, if the action and belief dichotomy was really operating as it should, then, you know, certainly sending your children to school is an action, right? Or not sending them to school is an action. But there, you know, and you can say, well, this was a fundamental rights case, so therefore that's the difference. But there, you know, there is an action at issue, and yet the case comes out the opposite from the Reynolds case and from the Smith case. So that kind of, you know, is a distinction that while the court seems to really hang its hat on, breaks down and doesn't seem to be quite as important as the court thinks it is. Okay, that's all we have time for. Send me questions, and we'll have the review session on Tuesday. Have a good Thanksgiving. Hey. Yeah, I think that the way you do that is, I know that they post.